We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome back to Focus on WILL AM 580, Illinois Public Media. This is your host, Carol Spindell. The producer of Focus is Harriet Williamson. At the controls, we have Jason Croft. In this hour, we're talking with Melissa Harris Perry about her new book, Sister Citizen: Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America, for colored girls who've considered politics when being strong isn't enough. It's published by Yale University Press. Melissa Harris Perry is professor of political science at Tulane University, where she's founding director of the Project on Gender, Race, and Politics in the South. She's a columnist for The Nation magazine and appears regularly on MSNBC. Her new book, Sister Citizen, explains the results of a number of studies she has directed about attitudes and perceptions around the intersection of citizenship, race, and gender. In response to Hurricane Katrina, the Duke lacrosse team scandal, and Michelle Obama's tenure as the first African-American First Lady, she has surveyed Americans to better understand how perceptions and attitudes affect their concept of citizenship. The book focuses on the particular challenges facing Black women. If you would like to join our conversation with a comment or a question for our guest, call in at 217-333-9455, or from farther away, you can use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Melissa Harris Perry, welcome to Focus.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. Your book is subtitled Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America, but you also have a second subtitle that's more poetic and more positive, for colored girls who've considered politics when being strong isn't enough. As you wrote this book, did you just feel that it needed both of these to sum it up?
No, not at all. Basically, I wanted one and my press wanted the other, and we fought about it, so we ended up with both.
Hey, everybody's happy, huh?
Everybody's happy or everybody's sad. It's hard to tell. But, you know, I'd spent many, many years writing this book, and the subtitle for Colored Girls had been the one that I was regularly using and that, for me, spoke to what the book does, because part of the goal of the book is a kind of interdisciplinary engagement where I try to think through literature, poetry, art, as well as kind of traditional forms of political and social science. My wonderful press, on the other hand, Yale University Press, felt like readers might want to know what the book was actually about. and so Stereotypes, Shame, and Black Women in America is, I think, more descriptive of what, you know, of the topics that I actually engage. So in many ways, the multiple titles on the front of the book are instructive to both what the book engages substantively, but also how it engages those questions.
Well, maybe we should start with shame. I have to say I tended to think of shame as something psychologists study. But in this book, you consider the role that shame plays in determining whether or not people, in this case African-American women, look for political solutions to their problems.
Absolutely. So you're absolutely right that shame is something that psychologists study and something that authors and writers, particularly novelists, engage as a set of questions. But political scientists had really only thought about shame largely in terms of kind of interwar Germany and the issues of national shaming. Hmm. So there was some conversation about how international responses to Germany after World War I generated a kind of national shame that created a hyper-patriotism or nationalism that was then evoked in the run-up to World War II. But we had not had a lot of engaged questioning of how shame might work in a domestic American political context. And for me, as a scholar of African American women's politics and as a Black feminist, shame was a really important construct because so many of the ways that African American women are portrayed in our popular culture are shaming portrayals. They are meant to not just make an individual feel guilty about something that that individual has personally done or failed to do, but shaming is actually made to make us feel bad about ourselves for things that unrelated people who just happen to be part of our group have done or not done. And that, I think, has important political consequences.
Well, you point out that racism is a kind of collective shame, and that the whole point of the Jim Crow laws was that black people were seen as unfit to be close to white people, and therefore their presence in Southern society had to be managed through this legal code, which is certainly a very shaming kind of thing to experience.
Absolutely. I mean, shame has, you know, psychologists have talked about how shame has a physical posture associated with it, heads down, eyes averted, avoiding contact, because shame is described as a sense of being the malignant self, as though, you know, your very self is cancerous and can spread to others. Well, if we think about what the Jim Crow laws were, they were laws that legislated that African Americans actually take on the physical posture of shame in public space, that they avert their eyes from whites, that they hang their head, that they keep their voices soft, and that their very selves were malignant, so malignant that they were not allowed to use the same public facilities, drink from the same water fountains, attend the same schools, sit in the same theater seats, right? That's based on this kind of underlying idea that blackness might literally spread through miscegenation or social contact. And so we legislated shame in this country for more than 100 years. And although it is no longer a matter of law, it continues to be a matter of social practice where we keep perpetrating images of blackness and of black womanhood that I'm most interested in this book that are meant to say you are unworthy of full citizenship.
Now, your research shows that the shame of racism falls harder on black women in our society than it does on black men. And you link this idea of shame to the idea of recognition or misrecognition. Could you explain to us about that?
Sure. So the first thing is that that shaming falls very differently. The kinds of tools that are used to shame men are gendered just as they are gendered for women. I'm not sure I want to, you know, do a comparative oppression, but we do know, for example, that women in general are more more likely to experience the negative effects of shaming, in part because we socialize women of all races to care more about what others think about them than we do socialize men that way. So that's part of the kind of vulnerability to shaming. But the reason that this is political, from my perspective, is that it actually impacts who we are within the American state. This is not just about, you know, whether or not you feel bad when, you know, negative images of black women are portrayed in hip-hop or when The Help comes out and reinscribes a certain 21st century version of the mammy myth. I'm actually really interested in how, in an attempt to push back against those negative images, black women actually will take on a certain kind of sense of responsibility to counter the negative images in ways that might actually keep them from becoming as politically active on their own behalf as other citizens often have a right to be.
Well, you talk about three stereotypes of black women that are the most prevalent in our society: the mammy, the Jezebel, the sapphire. Maybe you could talk a little bit about those before we move on to how women respond to them.
Sure. So, you know, there are many ways that I might have approached this, and I addressed really just three, which is not the entire universe of what's possible when we think about African-American women and stereotypes. But there are three very powerful ones that emerged over and over again in my research. One is the myth of the black Jezebel, or the hypersexual black woman, the idea that African-American women are particularly lascivious, particularly sexually available. This is an old stereotype going all the way back to slavery, but continuing to have relevance in, for example, our welfare policies that are, you know, talked about in the public realm as though, you know, African-American women just have all these babies from all these men, and therefore we have to legislate around their sexual actions. The second stereotype I talk about is that of the black mammy. And although, you know, we can find it most readily in things like Gone with the Wind, where it's literally a black maid, mammy figure from the era before the Civil War, the fact is that this kind of magical black woman who can fix all of the life problems, particularly of the white women who she encounters, has a variety of different contemporary cultural permutations. So, for example, I look at the first Sex and the City movie and the ways that Jennifer Hudson's very well-played character was nonetheless one of these sort of magical characters who could come in and fix all the life problems of the women that she encountered. And then the third is that of the angry black woman, the idea that when African-American women express anger, that it's not legitimate, and it's not about the topic that they're angry about, but rather it's just a reflection of their personal disposition to be angry, to be emasculating, and to be sort of overpowering. And so in that way, I'm really interested in how those three in particular continue to affect black women's politics.
Well, you mentioned The Help. It's interesting that we have a book at the moment on the bestseller list and a movie in theaters that many, many people are going to see that does kind of reinvent this whole myth of the mammy. And I take it from some things you've written, you're not a huge fan.
Hey, that would be the understatement of the decade. That's right. I am not a huge fan of The Help.
Maybe you could tell us why.
Sure. So, look, I read the entire book first, and then I saw the film, and I saw the film as a work assignment from MSNBC, who told me to go and see the movie. And for me, I probably am having a stronger reaction to it than I might normally, in part because I had just finished publishing this book and had been thinking about the power of stereotypes of African-American women. You know, The Help, more than any other thing from my perspective that is problematic about it, is that it creates a set of romantic concepts about what happened in the 1960s in Jackson, Mississippi, or anywhere in the South, with black women who were domestic workers. Just to take one very concrete example, in the film, there is a scene where Medgar Evers, a civil rights activist, is killed. And as a result of his murder, the black women maids in the community go to the young white woman, Skeeter, who is the lead of the movie, and they decide to help her with her book project. I think I was so infuriated by that because after the assassination of Medgar Evers, in real life, in real Jackson, Mississippi, real women who were actually black women, who were actually working as domestic workers, did real things politically. They engaged, they marched, many of them under pain of great danger to themselves and to their families, to appropriate the real-life experiences and to take those stories and, instead of telling the truth about them, to create this kind of fictionalized narrative that what these women did was to go and tell their stories to a young white woman, I think is appalling. And part of what's so appalling about it is that because we don't teach the history of black women in America and their political organizing, we don't even realize that what we're watching on screen is a lie, and that in fact there was no young white woman writing down the stories of these domestic servants and then taking these stories and publishing a book that was somehow empowering. That's not what happened at all. In fact, quite the opposite of that happened, and lynchings and violence and rape and abuse are all just imagined and waved away out of this story so that instead this particular kind of 21st century storyline can emerge. There's lots and lots of other things wrong with it, but that's one really concrete example.
Well, I have to say that having grown up in the South in that era, I was sitting in the movie saying to myself, well, this wouldn't have happened, and this would never have happened, and this whole premise is not possible historically. But at the same time, I watched it with a very diverse audience, and it was very well received, which I thought was interesting.
It, incredibly well received. But I, you know, part of I talk about that a bit in the book too. Simply in terms of talking about how incredibly popular and inculcated into American culture the mammy image is. I mean, although I talk, for example, at one point about a monument that was going to be built on federal land to the mammy that had been approved but luckily was defeated. It would literally stand on the Washington Mall within eyesight right now of the new Martin Luther King Memorial had it been built in the 1920s when it was proposed. But although that concrete statue never came into being, we did, in fact, generate a very powerful mammy monument in our sort of Madison Avenue culture of sales. So Aunt Jemima is still one of the most profitable images ever used in American advertising to sell everything from pancakes to cookies to clothing. She was a staple in sort of the good housekeeping version of American domesticity in the mid-century. And so that image of the Aunt Jemima or of the Black Mammy has been a very, very powerful one. It's one that really reaches into core places that we don't always acknowledge or know about. And so its massive popularity, this kind of return of the Black Mammy during a time of economic downturn, does not surprise me. It's almost like, you know, America, you know, at war, in economic downturn, in a time of international and domestic insecurity, is once again reaching out for America's mammies.
Interesting. All right. Well, I just want to say that this is guest host Carol Spindell, and you're listening to Focus, and we're talking today with Melissa Harris-Perry about her new book, Sister Citizen. If you would like to join our conversation with a comment or a question for Melissa Harris-Perry, you can call us at 217-333-9455 or at 1-800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. So we'd be glad to hear from you. Now, you have a metaphor that you weave through the book, which is very powerful, and I'd like to get you to talk a little bit about that. And that's the metaphor of the person in the crooked room.
Yes.
The person is in the room, but the room is slanted. And I guess this is based on some actual research.
Yeah, so this research is actually research that's simply about how our brains work. It's cognitive research from the 1950s and 60s. And it was about the way psychologists framed it was the notion of field dependence. And field here, you want to think of your visual field. So how dependent our brains are on our visual field in order to figure out what's up and down. So what they would do is put a subject in a room, turn the lights on in the room, and everything in the room would be slanted or crooked. The angle of the wall would not be 90 degrees. The pictures on the wall would be hung at an angle. The door would be crooked. And then they would ask the subject to find a way to get their movable chair straight up and down. If you're a field-independent person, if you're not dependent on the images in the field around you, you can find the straight up and down even though everything that you're seeing is slanted. But if you're field-dependent, as a majority of Americans are, or excuse me, not Americans, but a majority of these subjects were, international studies, if you're field-dependent, you can be tilted as much as 45 degrees in this chair, but experience yourself cognitively as being straight up and down because you're in line with the slanted images. Now, although this was cognitive research, the first time I read it, it felt to me like a metaphor for the experience of being an African-American woman in the U.S. It's like being trapped in a room where all the images coming back to you, all the stimuli in your field are crooked or off-kilter. You're getting a mammy image or a Jezebel image or an angry Black woman image all the time, and you're fighting to find the true upright despite all these crooked images. So I use that metaphor of the crooked room as a way of trying to think through the political work that it is to try to stand up and down, you know, straight in a space where all the images that you experience are off kilter.
Now, you point out that when black women are living in the crooked room, they're also being held responsible for what I believe it's W.E.B. Du Bois called the degenerative conditions of African-American experience. And it's just the problem is that these African-American women are bad housekeepers, they're inattentive mothers, they're poor educators. This was pointed out in the Moynihan Report in the 1950s. There was the whole media uproar during the Reagan administration about fictional welfare queens. So women in general tend to be held responsible for societal disorder, then therefore African-American women are responsible for all African-American disorder and difficulty, and that is a really big burden to carry.
Yeah, undoubtedly. And, you know, I think that you can see this still in so much of our discourse, if you're careful when you watch it, and that is this idea that black women as mothers are generating a kind of social disorder simply by parenting independently, right? So this language that black communities are degrading as a result of black women's single parenting, and that the degrading of black communities leads to crime and drugs, which victimizes the whole country. And, you know, that over and over again, there's this sort of notion that chaos issues forth from the womb of black women and from the households of black women, who if only they would be adequate as parents and adequate as decision makers could somehow, you know, save the rest of us from disorder simply by sort of getting themselves together. And again, I try in the book to link this experience or this discourse all the way back to slavery and to Jim Crow, not in order to say that this moment is just like that moment, but rather in order to say that it's not brand new and that it does have historical roots and that it matters for us to pay attention to it, because it should challenge whether or not it's true with a capital T to say that the source of the problem is this thing, given that the notion that the source of the problem is black women has such an old and ugly history.
Well, black women cope with this stress and respond to these stereotypes you point out by holding on to an idea, a sense of mythic strength. They are going to just create this self-image, a collective self-image of imperviousness, of dogged strength, of superwomanhood. So from outside, we have these myths of these angry black women, this sexual woman, or this mammy nurturing woman. But from within, black women have cultivated their own myth, the woman who's always strong, always tough. She can handle whatever comes along.
Yeah, I've been really interested particularly in this response on the part of black women, in part because, you know, I want to be really clear that although these are sort of terrible social realities, they are not the totality of black women's lives, right? It's not as though African American women across American history have been just sort of battered and you know, are falling apart. In fact, quite the opposite. It's pretty stunning to see how much black women have resisted and how effectively they've managed to create a political and social action despite these negative stereotypes and their political impact. But that said, sometimes, even as we are trying to find that upright in the crooked room, we actually end up bending too far to the other direction to try to overcompensate. And in this case, I'm interested in thinking about how, you know, here we are faced with these negative stereotypes, and instead of bending to them, we actually try to push back against them with this kind of active coping style, saying, no, 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 I can fix it, I can do it, I'm the strong black woman. And the fact is that there are a variety of personal, psychological, physiological, and ultimately political consequences to believing that it's your sole responsibility to fix all of these inequalities. The most important political consequence from my perspective is If you think it's your sole responsibility to fix everything, then you might not make the demands on the state that you, after all, have every right to make, because those demands are the basic demands that all citizens should have a right to make.
Okay, we're going to take a brief break, and then we'll be right back with our guest, Melissa Harris-Perry, to talk more about her book, Sister Citizen.
On the next Fresh Air, how one State Department employee spent time rebuilding Iraq.
We had money everywhere. It was literally in boxes that you had to step over. At one point in time, I had $100,000 in cash in a small safe in my office. I felt like a drug dealer.
Peter Van Buren's new book is We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from AAA Storage in Urbana and Champaign, offering both climate-controlled and regular storage in all sizes with facility managers on site. AAA Storage, 1710 North Cunningham, Urbana, and 2202 North Market in Champaign.
Welcome back to Focus on WILL AM 580, Illinois Public Media. This is your host, Carol Spindall. And today we're speaking with Melissa Harris-Perry about her new book, Sister Citizen, Shame, Stereotypes, and Black Women in America, for colored girls who've considered politics when being strong isn't enough. And I'd like to tell you that you can join our conversation with a comment or a question. You can call us at 217-333-9455. You can use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We would love to hear from you. And we do have a caller on line 4 in Heffingham. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Two questions. I'm wondering if your guest has any depth on the history of our species and the advent of patrol males who have acceded now to absolute power, and how that has occurred, and the overwhelming of socialized Homo sapiens in the process. And the other is where and how can femmes get the sort of power that they had early on in Homo sapien history.
Okay, thank you. Well, I don't know.
I'm not completely sure that I understand everything about the framing of the question, because it sounds like some of it's being framed in language that is bioevolutionary, which as a social scientist I tend to try to avoid, because it always feels essentialized to me rather than around social construction. But I think what I heard the caller ask about was kind of the preference for masculinity that is part of the system of patriarchy, right? A system that says men's bodies are more valuable, and that particular kinds of men's bodies, those that are that hold both behaviors and physiological components associated with masculinity, are always more valuable than those associated with femininity. So, for example, we value a man who makes a lot of money more than we value a man who is caring and compassionate towards his loved ones and children, for example, because those are considered feminine attributes. I don't think about this at all in the book in terms of any kind of evolutionary biology, but I do think it is it's a very smart sort of extension that others might be interested in terms of thinking through the overall and overreaching power of patriarchy that values men and masculinity over women and femininity.
Okay, well, I hope that answers your question. Thanks very much for calling in. A great deal of your research looked at what happened in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit, and the attitudes of people afterward about the kind of help they have or have not received from the government, and also the attitudes of the rest of Americans who watched the disaster on television. Now, among the people who watched this coverage on television in 2005, was there consensus about what happened? Did you find consensus among them?
I don't think there's any consensus. There certainly was in the immediate aftermath of the levee breaches post-Katrina a huge racial gulf between how black and white Americans received the racial aspect of Katrina. And I want to be really clear about this, that most Americans, regardless of ideology, partisanship, race, were angry and upset about what was happening in August of 2005. No one thought it was fair or reasonable to have left so many citizens abandoned in the city. That said, for so many African Americans, well over two-thirds of African Americans, their perception was that the government, the response of government failure, particularly federal government failure, was racialized. And the vast majority of white Americans did not believe that this was primarily a racial issue. They saw it as a failure of bureaucracy or of how government operated. But even among those African Americans who believe that there was a racial story to be told about Katrina, that doesn't mean at all that there was consensus about the nature of that racial story. You know, some believe that it was a kind of pure and blatant racism on the part of those who were empowered at the time, right? So this is the kind of Kanye West argument, George Bush doesn't care about black people. Others felt like it was more of a long history of race. So the levees that failed, at least in the city of New Orleans, were levees that protected poor communities and black communities. The levees in wealthier communities held. And so many saw this as a sign of long-term municipal neglect for those neighbors, those neighborhoods that were considered less valuable because of their race or economic status. That's a little different than saying, oh, the president doesn't like black people. It's a longer sort of structural story about black communities are more vulnerable. So even for those who believe that race was important, there was still not consensus about the way that race was important.
You describe a meeting that you went to, I believe it was about a month after the hurricane hit in New Orleans, and African Americans were particularly angry at being described as refugees. One man wanted people to pause and recognize the loss of thousands of people. He felt that the country was kind of going on about its business, which seems like a really normal response when you've experienced a disaster like that and the rest of the country hasn't and kind of moves on quickly. But he said, I'm a homeowner who's homeless. I'm a taxpayer and a voter. So these people spoke up and they said, we want to be seen as citizens, not as refugees. Refugees would be people from another country.
Right. No, this is, you know, this is really, this refugee language is one of the most important parts of the sense of neglect and feeling that people had post-Katrina disaster. There is nothing wrong with being a refugee. That is not itself a derogatory term. But it is a term that means something in particular when we evoke it, and that is refugees are typically understood as people who have crossed a national border because of conflict in their home country. People who are seeking refuge within their own country, there's a term for it. It's called IDP, internally displaced persons. But it's not refugee. It's a different language. So when Katrina victims and survivors were called refugees, it was a way of discursively saying in the media that these people are not really Americans who can make the same claims on the American state. You know, they're refugees who are basically relying on our goodwill as Americans. And that's inappropriate. They are, in fact, American citizens. I kept saying, you know, what if someone had looked at all of those African Americans trapped on the roofs of their home in the Katrina floodwaters and said repeatedly on television, the Democratic voters are trapped in their houses. Look at all those voters. I said, you know, you might have gotten a very different response had we reminded people that New Orleans voters are, for example, a stronghold of the Democratic Party in the state of Louisiana. The other thing that I talk a bit about in the book and that was very important from my perspective in the days following the storm was the number of people who had large American flags that they were waving for rescue. And You know, one might ask yourself, where do you get a large American flag? Why would that be in your home? And so often, those flags are the flags that are placed across the caskets of veterans who die in foreign war or in service to our country. And the fact that so many people who were trapped in New Orleans had those flags is indicative that they are truly citizens who had family members who have made the ultimate sacrifice for this country. And so to be labeled as kind of outside of the American story, I think was a kind of misrecognition, right, if we're talking about misrecognition, that we literally could not recognize them as American citizens. Instead, we transformed them into foreigners.
In waving that flag, they were trying to say, I'm not only a citizen, I'm an exemplary citizen.
Exactly.
And this was one case where you quote the woman who is in the Spike Lee film and who wrote a memoir who basically said, hey, this strong black woman stuff, you know, this did not help in Katrina. We were desperate. We needed help. And that's a kind of, it was interesting to hear her speak in those terms, because so many of the black women in the book do speak in the terms of that kind of discourse of, I can do all this, I can hold it together. But that was one case where nobody could hold it together.
Exactly.
These people needed help. And there was a lot of anger afterwards that they didn't get it. You put together a large study to look at attitudes of African Americans in the weeks following Katrina. You also compared that with findings and feelings and attitudes of Americans after 9/11 and differences in geographic proximity, people in New York versus people farther away, and so on. I would imagine that proximity probably played a role also in Katrina. If you were closer to New Orleans, you've probably felt more strongly about it.
In fact, no.
No.
And I think that's what was so stunning is, you know, post 9/11, again, everyone in America felt horrible, had a kind of post-traumatic stress reaction to it. But we found, in this case, researchers at NORC found very real geographic differences. So those who lived in New York and D.C. experiencing the most emotional distress, those who lived in big cities in general experiencing some heightened emotional stress, with everyone else falling behind. But overall, a kind of the response had to do with a sense of vulnerability based on a fairly reasonable determination of whether or not you were more likely to experience a terrorist attack because of being near or in New York, D.C., or another large city. So when we looked at the emotional reactions post-Katrina in a survey that we did about 4 weeks after the storm, you know, we thought, okay, people who live in low-lying areas or in coastal areas or those in the Gulf South or maybe those who had recently experienced tornadoes or earthquakes would be having heightened emotional response, but that's not what we found. Mm. Instead, we found that the distinction was racial, that black Americans, regardless of where they lived, were having tremendously heightened negative emotions in the weeks immediately following Katrina, and white Americans, no matter where they lived, were not having this heightened negative emotional response. So in this case, the disaster, at least for African Americans, was not understood so much as a geographic disaster. It was understood as a racial disaster, that the thing that made you vulnerable was being a black American, not living below sea level.
Interesting. You also showed people in this study two photographs. One showed a white family in a boat. There's a flooded neighborhood behind them. Another showed a black mother carrying two very small children, a baby and a very small child, also with flooded streets behind her. Both pictures were from Newsweek. And after showing people one or the other of these pictures, they had to choose between different statements about government response and how much government response was appropriate. And that, I thought the results of that were very interesting and complicated.
Yeah, again, in this case, the dominant framing, that of an African-American woman and her children and the language of refugee, because we varied either refugee or American, led white Americans to be statistically significantly less likely to support government funding for the rebuilding of New Orleans. So we actually see that these misrecognitions have policy consequences. When the misrecognition of black women is labeled through this discourse of refugee instead of American, we actually see people being less willing to use government resources to assist in their suffering.
Another study that you cited in the book did find that Katrina survivors seeking housing, among Katrina survivors, African-American survivors did experience more discrimination as they tried to find somewhere to live after the storm. They had fewer calls returned. They were quoted higher prices. There were a number of things where they were not treated in the same way that white survivors who were seeking shelter were treated.
Absolutely. I mean, again, so these policy consequences were both happening at the level of sort of, you know, voters. But the other piece of it was, you know, can you imagine having just experienced the displacement and the loss of life and of property and of everything familiar, going on to a website called KatrinaHousing.org or, you know, Help for Katrina Survivors, for example, and finding ads for housing that say, I'm not racist, but whites only, or I'd be happy to house a refugee family, often using the refugee language, a refugee family, but in order to make things more understandable for our children, whites only. This is not only disturbing, this is illegal. There is a National Fair Housing Act of 1968, which makes it illegal to discriminate on the basis of race, even in private property rental. So even if you have a room in your house that you're renting or even giving away, you cannot advertise discriminatory choices on the basis of race. And yet that's exactly what we saw post-Katrina. And it just adds to the sense that...
Again, the tilted room.
Absolutely.
The room is really tilted, but nobody seems to be stepping in and straightening that picture.
Absolutely.
So I want to remind our listeners, we'd be glad to have you join us. You can call us, 217-333-9455, or 1-800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu if you'd like to join our conversation with Melissa Harris-Perry. I was wondering if you happen to have read the Dave Eggers biography called Zaytoun, about a Syrian immigrant who got caught up in Katrina. He's also not recognized for who he is, someone who's trying to protect his property and help people.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think that's such a great example because precisely what happens is this sort of misrecognition of his identity and the misrecognition of identity around the post-9/11 era in the U.S. is one of the most powerful and interesting examples of this occurring. So I have a friend and colleague who did a brilliant film after 9/11 about violence against Sikh men all across the United States, much of this violence perpetrated against them because Sikh men wear turbans. And there was this kind of American ignorance that turban-wearing men are potential Muslim terrorists. Now, it wouldn't make it okay to commit acts of violence against someone if they were legitimately Muslim. But the very fact that there was first a misrecognition that that Muslims are somehow our enemy because of 9/11, and then a second misrecognition of Sikhs as Muslims, and then the acts of violence. And so you begin to see the multiple layers of consequence of these kinds of misrecognitions. So this is a book about African-American women, and it is unapologetically a book about black women. But the processes, the political processes here, should have broader meaning. They are not exclusively about the experience of being a black woman.
Well, that's so interesting, and I was struck by, when I did read Zaytoun, by the anger that his white American wife feels, who's born in the U.S., is not an immigrant, but is Muslim by choice, and she's the one who feels the angriest and has the longest-term sort of post-traumatic stress because of what happens to him, because she feels so betrayed by her government. She believed that her government would help her, and she really experiences some of those feelings that Black women have experienced for a long time, I thought.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. There is a, one of the ways I sometimes talk about the experience of being a Black person who is an American patriot. In other words, loving your country is a very, very painful, often unrequited love affair. And the extent to which people of color have embraced the promises of the American possibility from the beginning. I mean, really from the first death of Crispus Attucks at the beginning of the Revolutionary War, through the efforts of Black Union soldiers at the Civil War, through the efforts of Black taxpayers and civil rights activists who consistently frame their work as an attempt to bring about kind of the fruition of the American dream, that is consistently met historically with a kind of rejection of and a misrecognition of Black and Black American life. And, of course, African Americans are not the only one having this unrequited love affair with the American with the American state. It's something that we can see.
That's right. We know that American Indians serve in the military at much higher rates than their proportion in the population.
Absolutely. American Indians, Latinos who have either immigrant pass or are fairly new immigrants to the U.S. I mean, we see this over and over again. And so part of what I'm trying to get at here is just how tough it can be to do the work of citizenship within the context of an unrequited love affair.
Now, you looked at a public health study undertaken in Detroit in 1995 that looked at some of these issues, asked several hundred men and women, both Black and white, I don't know if there were other ethnic groups in the mix as well, but asked them about their emotional and physical well-being. And Black women did report lower levels of physical health and lower levels of life satisfaction than either white women or Black men. And it seemed like their family obligations were also more of a burden to them than the family attachments and obligations of other groups felt to them. So you went through this study and looked for relationships between factors, and you found that life satisfaction correlates with good health for both Black and white women. That's not too surprising. This whole idea of a sense of self-reliance did not seem to correlate.
Well, this is one of my favorite data points in the whole book.
And
so I'm really glad that you brought it up because there, you know, I use this self-reliance scale, right? This idea of sort of, you know, everything relies on me. I have to work, you know, twice as hard. All of this, and so one of my favorite data points is this idea that African American women, who have the fewest structural resources, right, the least education, the least wealth, you know, the smallest incomes, are, however, the group most likely to claim a strong sense of self-reliance, this idea that everything, all the outcomes rely on them. And so, you know, if this strong Black woman notion or this sort of independent American spirit were enough to sort of push back against the lack of resources and just make us feel better, then you ought to see that that sort of self-reliance should correlate positively with a stronger sense of life satisfaction.
Yeah.
And it does not. In fact, what we see is that this kind of active self-reliance combined with minimal structural resources, again, can have real physical and psychological effects that are negative, right? So that you actually end up with negative health outcomes and negative psychological outcomes when you believe that you can do it all on your own, but you don't actually have the resources to do it all on your own.
Well, we have a caller on line one in Urbana. So, hello, are you there on line one?
Yes, hi. This is probably a very small part, but it just you just kind of inspired me with a thought in this conversation. I'm a white American woman, and it's interesting to me that this I've never tied in American dream, that concept, with just what has happened to people in this country of color, because it's always been amazing to me that there wasn't just total bitterness and total anger and against the system. And you know, sometimes I think we all have this sense of American dream, and I guess we all have it in slightly different ways, perhaps, depending on our issues. And it was just interesting to me. I've just never heard that tied in with the American dream and how that idea of this dream can be so powerful. At any rate, I don't know that I'm being very articulate.
Well, thank you so much for calling.
I haven't thought it out well enough, but it's
a very interesting comment. So thank you very much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. I greatly appreciate it, and I think that that question about sort of how we tie in the notion of the American dream and this sense of shouldn't everyone just be bitter. My former colleague Cornel West at Princeton talks about the gifts of black folk in the age of terrorism. And one of the things he says is in a post 9/11 world, we have to remember that 9/11 was not the first act of terrorism, that one way to describe the experience of lynching is an experience of terrorism. And so if we look at how black Americans responded to that 100 years of lynching terrorism, it was not with a call to pull back civil liberties or to go to war in the way that so many of us responded in a post 9/11 context. And so he says that's a kind of gift of black folks to understanding how to react in the age of terrorism. So I very much appreciate the caller for also making a very similar point here.
We're running out of time here, and so many things we didn't get to that are in this book. We didn't get to the fact of Michelle Obama. Maybe you could quickly comment on that. This is seen by a lot of African-American women as a chance to end some of these stereotypes, to have a first lady like her.
Yeah, well, so, I do end with Michelle Obama in part because I don't want to be cliche and end with Barack Obama. So I end with the first lady rather than with the president in an attempt to show that these negative stereotypes and the work of trying to stand up straight in the crooked room is not just about class, although class is part of it. I mean, it's harder to do this work, obviously, with fewer economic resources. But even if you can imagine having the resources that are present in being, the First Lady of the United States, these are nonetheless very, very powerful stereotypes.
And unfortunately, we've got to end it there.
Sorry.
Thank you so much, Melissa Harris-Perry, for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, everyone. You've been listening to Focus. This is Carol Spindell, Illinois Public Media.
Folk in the age of terrorism. And one of the things he says is in a post 9/11 world, we have to remember that 9/11 was not the first act of terrorism, that one way to describe the experience of lynching is an experience of terrorism. And so if we look at how black Americans responded to that 100 years of lynching terrorism, it was not with a call to pull back civil liberties or to go to war in the way that so many of us responded in a post 9/11 context. And so he says that's a kind of gift of black folks to understanding how to react in the age of terrorism. So I very much appreciate the caller for also making a very similar point here.
We're running out of time here, and so many things we didn't get to that are in this book. We didn't get to the fact of Michelle Obama. Maybe you could quickly comment on that. This is seen by a lot of African-American women as a chance to end some of these stereotypes, to have a first lady like her.
Yeah, well, so, I do end with Michelle Obama in part because I don't want to be cliche and end with Barack Obama. So I end with the first lady rather than with the president in an attempt to show that these negative stereotypes and the work of trying to stand up straight in the crooked room is not just about class, although class is part of it. I mean, it's harder to do this work, obviously, with fewer economic resources. But even if you can imagine having the resources that are present in being, the First Lady of the United States, these are nonetheless very, very powerful stereotypes. And
unfortunately, we've got to end it there.
Sorry.
Thank you so much, Melissa Harris-Perry, for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, everyone. You've been listening to Focus. This is Carol Spindell, Illinois Public Media.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
And in the minute before 12 o'clock, I'm Jeff Bossert with this look at the markets at this midday in Kansas City. Hard red winter wheat for December, 741 and a quarter. That is up 10. December wheat in Chicago, 648 and a quarter, up 7.5. March, 682 and three quarters, up 7.5. December corn, 645 and three quarters, up 7.25. March, 658 and three quarters, up 6.75. May, 666 and a quarter, that's up 6.75. November soybeans, 1255 and three quarters, down 2.25. January, 1267, down 2. March, 1274, down 2.5. October soybean meal, 326.70, up 70. October soybean oil, that's at 52.13, down 27. October live cattle, 159.52.5, up 270. December, 119.70, down, or rather up to 297.5. September feeder cattle, 132.95. That's up 85. October